Does she or doesn't she? We'll hear from the woman behind some of the most famous advertising campaigns in history.
Immerse yourself first in the research and then immerse yourself in a bottle of wine. And that's how he considered that good advertising was written.
Plus, why money books might be bad for women, measuring gross national happiness, and a profile of a writer who gave her life to save others. I'm Susan Barnett, and it's coming up on 51% The Women's Perspective. The entertainment industry frenzy over the return of AMC's Mad Men series highlights our fascination with an era that, in decorating terms, is now known as mid-century modern. The pay-and-place antics of the advertising company seem too big to be true, but according to a woman who was there, a real-life Peggy Olson, they've got it right. Jane Moss, one of the women pioneers of advertising, has written in Mad Women, The Other Side of Life on Madison Avenue in the 60s and Beyond, that it's all true, with one exception. Women, she said, had to wear gloves and heels in the office, and women copywriters had to wear hats, too. She was immersed in that world, working at a firm run by the legendary David Ogilvy, and she spoke with 51%'s Katie Britton.
As you say in the very beginning of the book, there are some things you can't not talk about when it comes to advertising in New York City, especially because of the TV show Mad Men, and that's sex, drinking, and the clothing.
I think people sort of wear neon signs in their foreheads that blink on and off and say, either I'm available or I'm not available. And I think my sign flashed, I'm not available. And most men took that fairly seriously. I think everybody I worked with knew that I was very joyously, exuberantly married. And with the exception of the one creative director who sexually harassed me for about 2 years, I really was quite protected.
And about that sexual harassment, there really wasn't any place that you could go to or an HR department because it was all run by men and their thoughts were like, men, well, you must have done something to advance it or you're crazy. So then that would automatically blacklist you.
Yes, it was not done, Katie, to go and whine and carry on about it. A woman was expected to handle little difficulties like sexual harassment quietly and well and not make a fuss about it. And as you said, there was no HR department. At Ogilvy, we had an office manager, but he was the one who got so drunk on the annual Ogilvy boat ride that he fell overboard and had to be fished out of the Hudson River. So he wasn't much help in the sexual harassment area. And Michael would have come to the office with his Marine Corps rifle and shot him. So I couldn't tell Michael. And so ultimately, I broke the code of silence and went to talk to David Ogilvy and said that I wished that I could get transferred to a different creative group because I thought it would help me to learn more about the advertising business, to have a change of... And then I started to cry quietly, and David, bless his heart, great man that he was, pretended he didn't see me crying, and he just said, I think it would be a very good idea for you to be switched to another group, and within 2 days, he made that happen.
And you were quite lucky with the group of people you had working at Ogilvy and Mather.
I was indeed.
I mean, some of the campaigns that you worked on were just absolutely amazing. And even with the dove and the doves flying in the window.
Well, actually, at one point, we hired the trainer from Hollywood who had trained the birds in Hitchcock's movie The Birds. And he said, after those nasty ravens, these doves are going to be pretty easy. But what he didn't realize is that the doves had to do many, many, many takes. In television commercials, you do 30 or 40 takes of the same scene as opposed to movies where you do maybe 3 or 4 takes. And so the doves got bored and they flew up and roosted in the rafters of the studio. And we had to go and get nets and get them down.
So it's interesting how there were different camps of thinking when it came to advertising in the 60s, how some felt it had to be pounded into the consumer's mind with repetition, while others went with the irreverence.
Well, of course, the Irreverence was brand new in the 60s. That was the brand new school of the advertising revolution, which was don't take your product all that seriously. For the first time in the history of advertising, Katie, it was okay to say, Avis is only number two. We have to try harder. Admitting your product was number two had never been done before. To say Volkswagen is a lemon, or think small and have a little tiny picture of the little beetle, or to call it a bug, was just, well, it set the advertising world on end, because it had no one dared to be so cavalier with their products before. And then there was the David Ogilvy School, which was do a great deal of research. David said, immerse yourself first in the research, and then immerse yourself in a bottle of wine. And that's how he considered that good advertising was written. But you really had to do your homework, and you had to know the consumer inside and out. You had to know what he or she was thinking and wanted. And then you geared your message to those wants and needs.
And so that's how you came up with the I Love New York campaign. I mean, it is still going strong.
Yes, isn't it wonderful? Every time I go anywhere to any city in the world, I am bound to see T-shirts and coffee mugs that say, I heart somewhere, I heart Paris, I heart London, I heart Tokyo. And I just think, well, it's a campaign that certainly has lasted for a long time and has spread around the globe. And after working for so many years on detergents and toilet bowl cleaners, it's wonderful to know that I was helpful. I played a role in helping the state of New York get back on its economic feet, and particularly help the city of New York.
As you were progressing at Ogilvy, did you realize what a pioneer you were? I mean, you started as a copywriter and then you were promoted to vice president, and you were a pioneer, I believe, in both terms of advertising and women's rights.
Well, certainly in terms of women's rights, I was aware of the fact that I was making a statement. When my first daughter was born, I took a week off. And then I went back to work. And when my second baby was born, Mabel met me at the hospital. I handed the baby to her. She went home with the baby, and I went to the office. And I didn't have to. You know, nobody had a stopwatch on me to see if I'd be back in a day or 10. But I was making a point that women could, you know, drop babies in the pee patch and head right back to work. And so I knew I was pioneering in terms of women's rights and women's freedom. I don't think I knew that I was pioneering so much in terms of advertising, because so much was going on, Katie. The revolution was continuing, and we had all of those people, Mary Wells, Lawrence, and Jerry Della Femina, and George Lois, the crazy Greek, and everybody was breaking rules and doing terrific advertising right and left. So maybe I thought of myself as one of many pioneers.
Are you nostalgic at all for that time in that era that you were working in advertising?
Well, I'm nostalgic for the fun we had, the passion we had for doing advertising, and the camaraderie. We all liked each other so much. We respected each other. We were passionate also about our agency. Those of us who worked at Ogilvy considered it was the best agency that had ever been invented. We adored David Ogilvy, who, by the way, was a gorgeous, sexy, yummy man. All the women had crushes on him, but he never, ever even gave us a second glance. And I'm nostalgic for that. It was a wonderful era that probably won't come back again, because the agency world has changed so much. There's much more pressure on agencies today. Clients are asking agencies to do more and make less. So agencies have to ask fewer people to do more. I think the work is harder. The rewards are not as wonderful. And I don't mean just financial rewards. I mean the rewards of saying, oh, I've just done some wonderful advertising. I don't think people have time to work on advertising as hard, because you've got much more to do. I watched the Super Bowl, of course, and watched not the football, but the commercials. And I thought that in general, the commercials were not as fresh. not as innovative as they have been in the past years. It seemed to me that our creative folks are trying a bit too hard to be funny, to entertain, and I think the brands and the message are suffering a bit because of that. That may be a little harsh, but that's what I thought watching that parade of commercials.
The name of the book is Mad Women, The Other Side of Life on Madison Avenue in the 60s and Beyond.
Coming up, measuring gross national happiness, looking at financial books for women with a critical eye, and remembering one of World War II's heroines. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at our flagship station, WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1188. Personal finance expert Manisha Thakur has written two books on money management for women, but she read an article that made her question whether she was actually creating problems rather than solving them.
Do personal finance books written by women for women perpetuate the myth that women are bad with money? Why is there a money management for women section, but no money management for men section at Amazon and other booksellers? And what's up with all the diet analogies in these books? Could they be any more demeaning? A recent Slate article entitled The Shopaholic Myth and a follow-up piece at the highly regarded personal finance blog Get Rich Slowly raise these very important questions. As a 40-something woman who co-authored two personal finance books for women, those questions hit me smack in the gut. These well-written articles by two journalists I very much admired, forced me to think long and hard about whether my focus on financial literacy for women was actually hurting women. My conclusion? With the exception of age-based asset allocation guidelines, where I feel women should invest their retirement funds slightly more aggressively than men to prepare for statistically longer lifespans, I'd argue that the fundamentals of Personal Finance 101 are identical for women and men. The reluctance of some younger women, notably in their 20s and 30s, to read female-oriented finance books, in a sense, is a huge victory for the equality movement. So here are the reasons why I still support personal finance books by women for women. Number one, women are not worse than men with money. Poor personal finance skills are rampant across gender lines. Why? The financial landscape has increased geometrically in its complexity over the past 20 years, while financial education has not kept up. Said simply, we can all use help. Number two, but modern life still has a tendency to spit in women's eyes as their career paths progress. The twin combination of what economists call occupational segregation, i.e. the tendency of women to voluntarily choose to work in less remunerative fields, combined with the time commitments of child-rearing and elder care, which lead women to spend an average of 11 more years than men out of the paid workforce, mean learning financial basics are all the more essential for women. It also means we need more dialogue on these areas of inequality, but that's for another time. Third and finally, the default language of finance is still male. As several op-ed writers have pointed out, our financial system might be in a very different and better place had it been Lehman Sisters instead of Lehman Brothers. As someone who worked in the financial services industry for 15 years, I'd argue the reason there is no Money Management for Men section at Amazon, is that male is still the default speak of the industry. Personally, I'm not interested in talking about my personal finance through the lens of football or golf metaphors, nor do I want to socialize over cigars and scotch. Well, maybe I drink the scotch. But thanks to pioneers ranging from Women & Co. and Directions for Women to Daily Worth and LearnVest, there are more organizations focusing on the way in which women enjoy learning and digesting the very same personal finance information as men. As for the prevalence of dieting analogies, personally, I think that's just smart. The equation for financial and physical health is identical. Inflows versus outflows. We all eat, we all spend money, so why not compare the two? As Occam's razor suggests, when faced with a choice, the simpler the path, the better the outcome. For 51%, I'm Manisha Thakur.
Manisha Thakur is a personal finance expert, an author, teacher, and the founder of Money Zen. Find out more at ManishaThakur.com. Gross national product, or the total value of a country's economic activity for a year, has long been the accepted measure of society's progress and health. But GNP is an indication of national wealth, and there's a lot it doesn't measure. Since the 1970s, Bhutan has been experimenting with another yardstick that ties prosperity to well-being. Charles Appel reports.
In Bhutan, gross national happiness trumps gross national product. GNH involves prudent management of scarce resources to ensure a secure life for all citizens. Jimmy Tinley, the country's prime minister, says business as usual cannot go on.
We desperately need an economy that serves and nurtures the well-being of all sentient beings on Earth and human happiness that comes from living life in harmony with the natural world, with our communities, and with our inner selves. We need an economy that will serve humanity, not enslave it.
Bhutan is the driving force behind a high-level meeting on happiness and well-being held at the United Nations. The remote kingdom in the Himalayas is sharing what it has learned with the world. Prime Minister Tinley insists it is still a work in progress.
Contrary to what many mistakenly believe, Bhutan is not a country that has attained GNH. And it is not from a pedestal that we serve as a humble facilitator today. Like most developing nations, we are struggling with the challenge of fulfilling the basic needs of our people. What separates us, however, from most others is that we have made happiness the most fundamental of human needs as the goal of societal change.
The idea that well-being encompasses more than material prosperity dates back thousands of years, says UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, citing the teachings of the Buddha and Aristotle.
Gross national product has long been a yardstick by which economies and politicians have been measured. Yet it fails to take into account the social and environmental cost of so-called progress. We need a new economic paradigm that recognizes the parity between the three pillars of sustainable development. Social, economic, and environmental well-being are indivisible. Together, they define gross global happiness.
With less than 75 days left until the Rio Plus 20 conference on sustainable development, the Secretary General is calling on all people to work towards a shared future that is more just and equitable. And Bhutan's Prime Minister hopes this happens before it's too late.
Mankind is like a meteor, blazing toward self-immolation, along with all other life forms. But this course can be changed if we act now.
Jimmy Tinley, Prime Minister of Bhutan, speaking at the meeting on happiness and well-being, defining a new economic paradigm. Charles Appel, United Nations.
Finally, throughout history, there are stories of people who sacrificed their own happiness for a greater good. Today, Gilles Malkin is the story of one such person, a writer who put down her pen, walked into danger, and never looked back.
Hanna Szenes was born in 1921 in Budapest. Her father was a writer, and Hanna began writing herself very early and never stopped. Theirs was a family of non-practicing Jews, but as the years passed, Hanna felt more and more oppressed for her origins. Feeling the pull of Zionism, she left in 1939 for Palestine and lived there on a kibbutz, joined by her brother in 1943. War broke out, and she tried to bring her mother out as well, but the necessary papers did not materialize. Hanna began to dream of helping her mother, even if it meant returning to Hungary to do so. As if by chance, she was informed of a plan to insert agents into the Balkans to help with the efforts to assist Jews, as well as to extract British air crews that had been shot down. Hanna immediately volunteered and began her training as a parachutist by the British forces in Haifa. The plan consisted of parachuting agents into Yugoslavia, getting them over the Hungarian border, and making contact with Jewish communities, helping escapees, and helping to produce resistance. Hanna was also designated and trained to be a radio operator. March 13, 1944, Hanna and 32 others were airlifted from Bari, Italy, into Yugoslavia. They were met on the ground by partisan forces, and 4 days later were told that, unfortunately, the German army had finally entered Hungary. Hanna was advised that the mission should be delayed until such time that the possibility of success was more of a reality, but she said that she felt that since they were the only means of help, delaying would only mean lives lost. She would not be talked out of it and decided to press on. On June 9th, she and several friends, two Hungarians and a French POW, crossed the border. Their contact was not at home, and they had to stay in the woods on the run. They were soon captured by Hungarian police. Hanna Szenes was tortured and interrogated by the Gestapo, but she refused to give up her radio code. She was then taken to Budapest, where her interrogators brought in her mother as added pressure. But Hanna stood fast. Hanna was held in prison for 5 months. Her trial was held on October 28, 1944, as a closed-door military tribunal. Hanna spoke openly and bravely to the judges, telling them she saw them as the true enemies of Hungary, and warned them that the war was about to end badly for them, and it would be better if they were to recognize an opportunity to lessen the charges that would be brought against them. On November 7, 1944, as the Arrow Crossers were fleeing Budapest, Hanna was executed by firing squad at the age of 23. Hanna Szenes' mission failed, but she is revered as a hero because she persisted in the effort with dignity, without fear, and with the true and unyielding purpose of saving her people, despite the complete might of the opposition. She refused to be cowed and dared to follow through in the face of impossible odds. She wrote beautiful poetry, and one of her best known was made into the world-famous song called Eli, Eli. The lyrics say, "O Lord, my God, I pray that these things never end. The sand and the sea, the rush of the water, the crash of the heavens, the prayer of woman and man." Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is a writer and musician. He lives in New York's Catskill Mountains. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also find a regular column related to 51% at feminist.com. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.